Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And I'm delighted to have Michael Hudson back on the program. Listeners are familiar with his views, economic primarily, and it's the kind of information that we need to get, and we try to concentrate all the time on this program. For those unfamiliar with Michael, he is a former Wall Street insider. He's a leading economist. He's an expert on financial history. He's a research professor at the University of Missouri. He's also an author, a consultant. He's the head of a Harvard-based economic and financial history group. He's the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. My goodness, I could fill the whole program with Michael's resume. Important also is he's a very fierce critic of all the stuff going on now, the bailouts and the criminal element in charge and so on and so forth. There's so much to cover, Michael. Let's try to get as much as we can into this hour. We want to cover at least a few things. And you surprised me about 10 minutes ago. You've got some breaking information about Iceland and the IMF. Can I ask you just briefly to talk about one thing? You sent me an article that may be a work in progress on the financialization of a free lunch. Uh-huh. And you talk about and you write about financialization of financialized wealth being extractive. It's not productive. Uh-huh. It undercuts industrial growth, and instead it extracts interest and it engages in short-term speculative gains. So right now there's a plan to strip mine the wealth out of Iceland and other countries. Briefly on that, then tell me this breaking news on Iceland.
Well, you've combined the history of economic thought with current events. So let me put it in perspective. The whole aim of classical political economy, from the physiocrats through Adam Smith and Ricardo and John Stuart Mill, all the way down to Marx and Henry George, was to minimize the cost of production. They wanted to reform industrial capitalism by getting rid of unnecessary costs of production. And there were two basic problems. One was the hereditary landlord class that took rent, and in what Adam Smith said, they loved to reap where they did not sow. In other words, it's a pure overhead payment to property owners. And secondly, the banking and financial class that made loans to governments instead of having the governments create their own credit and extracted interest. And the idea was that governments would create their own credit and they'd tax away the land rent and bring the price level of countries down to the technologically necessary cost of production. And everything the classical economists wrote was how to bring prices in line with cost value. In other words, market prices included a lot of added income, what Americans used to call watered costs in the 19th century, when the Wall Street would sort of add bonds to the railroads, and the Wall Street companies would just issue new bonds to themselves and then factor the interest on these bonds into the railway fares. And that kind of abuse, that something for nothing, that financial free lunch led to the antitrust laws in America in 1890. It led to the anti-monopoly laws. It led to the Interstate Commerce Commission. It led to regulate the economy so that there wasn't going to be an excess rent. And needless to say, the rentiers fought back. The landlords fought back.
We got a break, Michael. Let's do that and come back. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Michael Hudson. Michael, I guess what it comes down to, and please add more thoughts. I don't want to interrupt what you were saying, but I guess what it comes down to is that financialization, just that broad term, gives banks and financial institutions a free lunch, and labor and consumers bear the burden through income taxes, sales taxes in the U.S., payroll taxes, and a whole bunch of other taxes that people pay and don't even realize how much they're paying. And these big guys on the top that produce nothing get the free lunch.
Well, the problem is that it's not really free. All these costs add this debt service and debt leveraging. If you let people use interest as a tax-deductible expense, if you say you can get much richer by borrowing money rather than equity, if you tell them that the way to get rich is debt levering, all this interest adds to the cost of doing business. And if you untax real estate and you untax the higher brackets, then you have to make up this tax by shifting it onto labor and onto consumers, and that's what's happened. So the financialized economy is a high-cost economy. It's high-cost because the tax burden is shifted off wealth onto labor, and it's high-cost because it's increasingly indebted. And that was where we lead into Iceland and what's happening.
Correct me if I'm wrong. It seems to me that back in the 1980s when Reagan got through a couple of tax cuts, at least on one of them, a lot of people benefited. I benefited and so on. But I believe that he actually Greenspan, before he became Fed chairman, rearranged the payroll tax to shift a greater burden on ordinary people, and they actually raised the lowest income tax bracket. So people at the lowest level got a tax increase in that bracket. If that was the only bracket that they paid income taxes on, their taxes went up, while the richer element of the country got a couple of big tax breaks.
Basically, Greenspan added the FICA withholding for Social Security and Medicaid, Medicare, to about 12% of the wage burden. So that 12% was only paid by labor up to what in today's dollars would be about $100,000. And the higher brackets, it was over, I think, $44,000 at that time, didn't have to pay any of the Social Security tax. So instead of financing retirement, Social Security, and medical care out of the general budget, they only made the lower-income workers pay for it. So essentially they got a huge new tax rake-off from employees, and they used this income to cut taxes on the rich. And not only did they cut taxes, but they cut them, they gave a huge real estate write-off. So you could write off a new building you bought. If you were a landlord, you could write off the entire cost of the building in 7.5 years. So you would not have to pay any income tax at all if you were a property owner. And you got a tax write-off, so you wouldn't have to pay tax on any of the other income that you got as well. So the result was that under Reagan and Bush, the America's national debt quadrupled. This added to the budgetary costs, and the debt service on the budget began to crowd out social spending, and that was part of the overlayering of the economy with this kind of, you could call it, predatory taxation to benefit the financial and property sectors, or the sector.
It really is an upside-down system, because you can write off the cost of a building, incredible, while the value of the land increases, and I guess the value of the building increases at the same time. So you've got an asset increasing in value, and yet you're taking a tax write-off because you're writing it off.
And to support this, the Federal Reserve had to put out increasingly fictitious statistics on capital formation, on building values, on the asset sheets. So the Fed statistics became a function of really the small print of the tax code, and became more and more distorted as a picture of reality. So the people actually thought that the economy was getting richer and richer as it was going further into debt, as long as the debt bid up property prices by even more. So now that the property prices are falling, 2 years ago, and throughout all of American history, until 2 years ago, homeowners on balance owned more of their homes than the bank did. The year before last, the ratio fell to 49%. And this year, because of the collapse in property prices, on average, Americans only own about one-third of their homes. Banks own about two-thirds. And this is inverting all of the historical relationships. So people have to take on a lifetime of debt in order to obtain access to housing or an education or simply to maintain their living standards. And the result is that more and more of American income has to be paid out as debt. So that explains why American labor can't compete in the world. They have to pay so much for housing, so much for medical care, so much for taxes, and so much for debt service that even if they wouldn't eat and wouldn't buy clothes, if they worked naked without eating, they'd still be priced out of world markets.
It really is a terrible system. It's the reason that I like to say in some of my articles, Michael, that, of course, none of this is by chance. This is all planned, and it's been going on for many years. And very slowly, with a lot greater speed in the last year and a half or so, America is on track to be to being turned into Guatemala. We are literally being turned into a banana republic, and we're being militarized at the same time. Because
the whole world is turning that way. This is not unique to America. This is every single country has exactly the same phenomenon. So the idea that America sort of insists upon as part of its trade deals is that other countries load down their economy with debt, including the post-Soviet economy, so that no economy will have an advantage when it comes to getting rid of debt.
And what we don't hear about is there is an awful lot of unrest in countries, in the Baltic countries, in Ukraine, maybe some of the other former Soviet satellites. There are lots of distressed people in China that you never hear any news reports about. And China is doing well. China's lost millions of jobs, but yet apparently they still have a growing economy. But these policies are just wrecking world economies right across the globe, some more, some less. The ones that you've written about in Eastern Europe and so on, Russia, they are taking it very, very hard. But I'm dying to hear the latest news on Iceland and the IMF because I don't know what you're going to tell me.
Okay. Yesterday in England, in you know how in Parliament they have a question and answer system that is usually broadcast. I've just been checking under what Gordon Brown said. And Gordon Brown, when he was asked about a hospital in Manchester that lost £1 million by putting it in one of the Icelandic rogue banks at high interest, he said, "We're going to lean on the IMF and tell the IMF to act as our collection agent in Iceland." And immediately the IMF thought, "Oh my God, you know, this is not what the IMF is supposed to be for. We're not supposed to act as a collection agent for commercial bankers, demanding that governments tax their population in order to pay the bankers that hold the majority control of the IMF, the U.S. and England." So Gordon Brown came out and said, "The IMF is our collection agent. It does not work for the countries that are members. It works for the creditor countries, and we are in an antagonistic position towards the other creditor, the debtor countries. The IMF is essentially," he defined it, "is a almost military takeover." And this has very much embarrassed the IMF because the secret is out. In Parliament, Gordon Brown has said that the IMF is our collection agent. And immediately the Icelandic government protested and said, "Wait a minute, this bank that the hospital put the money in is a bank regulated by the British, the Bank of England, by the British. So for your bad regulation, you are demanding that the IMF impose taxes on and bankrupt the Icelandic economy to pay you." And Gordon Brown said yes.
Oh, my goodness.
So this is never in the history of the IMF has this been put so nakedly.
Well,
and not a word in the American press.
Oh,
not a word. And yet it was on American television on the parliamentary discussions, and it's on the Internet.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'll bet it gets some press coverage in the U.K. I don't know about the BBC, but there are some intrepid publications in the U.K. that absolutely will carry this, and I'm certain some columnists will write about it. Oh, my goodness, that really is breathtaking. Can we talk a little bit about Iceland's election and what's going on? By the way, Iceland has not tapped the IMF for funds as yet. Is that right?
It's made a standby agreement and met some of the conditionalities that it's supposed. The government is supposed to cut back spending, but it hasn't drawn down any of the money yet because the government of Iceland itself owes very little money. We should say something. Why was there an election? When the crooked Icelandic banks that were privatized failed last October, Iceland organized something very much like the post-Soviet color revolutions. They were called pots and pans or kitchen utensil revolutions. Every Saturday at 3 p.m., the housewives who were being strapped for debt would get together outside of Parliament and bang the pans, and there'd be a protest against the government. This brought down the corrupt neoliberal government there, the party that had been in power for, is part of a coalition for 18 years, the Independence Party, and the Social Democrats that for 6 years had shared the power with them, were brought down because Iceland, the banks essentially were broke. Does that mean we have to stop talking again?
Yeah, we need to take another break. Let's do that, and then we can wrap up Iceland to the bottom of the hour, then shift to the global economic situation, which I know is what listeners want to hear a good deal about. We will be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Michael Hudson. The reason we talk about Iceland and the reason we did last time is it is a symbol of what's going on all across the world. Some countries being harmed more than others. But this thing has just swept the globe. We have a global economic situation, and it really is just causing so much harm to so many millions of people. So Iceland had an election, and you wrote about it, Michael.
Iceland's more than a symbol. It's a creditor's paradise. It's the only country in the world where, in addition to paying normal interest on mortgages, the debts are indexed at the foreign exchange rate. So that if you, say, have a $100,000 house at the beginning of the year, it's now the house has now gone down to $80,000, but your debt's gone up to $120,000 because the mortgage is indexed to the price decline, which is 18% to 20% in the last year, is the Icelandic currency's collapse. And they've had to pay normal mortgage rates of about 6%. So the Icelanders are being expropriated from their houses by the harshest mortgage terms on the world. The debts are going up while the market is falling apart as Icelandic families are so short of money that the schools are now offering free lunches to the children so that the kids will have enough to eat. So it's a debtor's hell, meaning it's hell for the 99% of the population. And a small group of cronies, basically from the families that have run Iceland for the last few centuries, these are really the post-feudal aristocracies, run the country, privatized the banks. Milton Friedman came and convinced the country to privatize. So essentially, you had the entire island and public sector stolen by a small group of people, reducing the rest of the island to serfdom. So Iceland is the first country going back from capitalism into feudalism, into serfdom, sponsored by the now by the IMF and by the creditor class. So needless to say, there's a revolution. Today at 3 o'clock, there's going to be another pots and pans issue. They just, although the election was held on April 25th, nobody was discussing finance in the election. They were talking about basically whether to join the European Union or not. And the fantasy in among the Icelanders and the Social Democratic Party that won is that somehow joining Europe will solve the problem. They believe that Europe will stand up for the debtors, not the creditors, that they will stand up for Iceland, not the European banks. And it's a parallel universe of wishes that are the they don't believe that they'll be treated like Latvia and the post-Soviet economies and Hungary and reduced to debt peonage, which is what the European Union is all about.
Oh, indeed. And we did talk about this last time, Michael, and the fact that incredibly, Icelanders end up paying something like 23% interest on their mortgages. And
it's not interest. It's an indexation that increases the debt. So the interest is 6%, but a penalty rate of 18%. So it's not. Remember, penalties are much more than interest. In America, the credit card companies make more money on fees and penalties than they make in interest. So they've been redefining this. What it basically is a rake-off, and obviously it's an overhead. How could Iceland possibly produce exports and compete with anything produced by labor if the housing prices are going up at such an enormous rate?
So
the housing debts are going up.
The issue is exactly what will be the future course. Will the population continue to put up with this?
Well, that's why there are protests now, but there won't be another election for about 3 years, so they'll put up with it until there is the kind of protest that there was last October when the government fell as a result of the kleptocrats gambling away in banking. They privatized the banks. Iceland was paying 16% per year to borrow essentially from speculators and using the money to gamble, largely on derivatives and gambles that are guaranteed to lose $1 billion. For instance, one group of Icelanders met with Russians and made a series of deals where their bank depositors lost, I think, $1 billion on a trade saying, we believe it's going to be short sleeve weather in December, and instead it was cold in December, so they lost $1 billion to somewhere offshore in Anguilla through a central bank that seems to be controlled by the Russians. It's all crooked. And before the election, there was supposed to be a government report done by Deloitte and Viman, a British consulting firm, as to what happened to these bad loans. It was announced yesterday that there won't be any report, because if there was a report, it would be obviously clear that the government has been looted by the kleptocrats and the debts left on Iceland. So the government's essentially telling the people, we're not going to tell you who got the money. We're not going to prosecute the people. We're not going to tell you the conditions of the banks. But you're all going to have to pay for all the money that they've looted. They've run up a huge debt equal to about half of your income. So either you'll starve or you can emigrate. You can take your choice.
And you said if it gets bad enough, it's possible half the population could emigrate.
Well, they can't afford to live. If you can't buy food and you can't pay for housing and it gets really cold in Iceland in the wintertime, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Like the people of Haiti get on boats and they try to make it to South Florida.
I mean,
you do what you have to do in desperation. You said that we probably have some Icelandic listeners to this program. For those who tune in late, you can get this program on archives on republicbroadcasting.org or globalresearch.ca, and you can listen anytime.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Michael Hudson. Michael, let's shift to the big picture, the global economy overall, and let me throw a few things out, and then you take it, and your views are what everybody wants to hear. Right now, the headlines and the talk are revolving around the fact that the worst is over. The economy has bottomed. We see green shoots beginning to sprout up all over. Maybe growth will get stability. Maybe at least modest growth will begin to be seen sometime in the second half of the year. The Obama program seems to be creating some positive elements. We just went through this so-called bank stress test yesterday, and surprise, surprise, all the banks passed. Oh, they need a few billion here, a few billion there, but they all passed. But let me just a couple of other points, then you take over. In your past writing, you've talked about that we have a huge, huge debt problem that may be the core issue we need to deal with, this enormous debt problem. And you make the point that how can we solve a debt problem by piling on so much more debt? It's like taking a raging fire and just making it a bigger raging fire. One point from my co-host and editor of Global Research, Michelle Chosudovsky, in a past article, he wrote that he believes the Obama economic agenda is counter-stimulative. He calls it the most drastic curtailment of public spending in U.S. history. And the reasons he gives is because of the banker bailouts, the huge military defense budget and foreign wars, and all of the debt service that is on the order of about $500 billion a year. Your thoughts?
I think his analysis is right. If in order for a recovery to occur this year, the depression we're in has to be the shallowest recession in American history. And that's just crazy. It's the worst since the 1930s. Everybody knows that. So the government is just trying to convince people, if you believe our fantasy, maybe you'll begin to borrow again and spend to support your living standards, and maybe that will get sales going again. But nobody's listening to that. Everywhere I walk in New York City, down every street, you see for rent signs on the stores and on the restaurants. The restaurants are emptying out. People are the largest increase in consumption in the last few months has been Kraft's packaged macaroni and cheese. And you can go to Target, and for 59 cents a package, you get the Kraft macaroni and cheese. So this doesn't sound like a recovery to me. It means that finally the American public is so shocked to find out that it's been lied to all the time that of course there's not going to be recovery this year. People know that they have to save their money. They have to repay the debts. And they're trying to get out as fast as possible. But as they repay the debts, they're doing it by eating Kraft food instead of going to restaurants. And they're cutting back. So, I don't think it helps for the government to deliberately lie to the people. And I don't think it helps for Obama to tell lies on behalf of Wall Street saying, prosperity's right on the, around the corner. You can, go into debt again. I think this is crazy. And it makes Obama even more to the right of, George Bush, who never came out and said this kind of crap. It's amazing that you'd have a president who's standing behind a systematic lying about the economy.
And they said the same thing back in the early 1930s, at least while Herbert Hoover was still in office.
But they believed it then because it was something that was altogether new. There hadn't been something like that in the 30s. So you had serious people like Irving Fisher, who lost his fortune, actually putting the money where he believed there'd be a recovery. And then later, after the crash and after he lost his fortune, he wrote a book on debt deflation, explaining how debts deflated the economy. This time, there's no excuse. The government knows that what Mr. Geithner came out yesterday was a lie. And it's a lie because he said, if we assume there won't be a recession this year, if we assume that unemployment will not rise, then the banks are in good condition. So we're going to give banks money at 1% and let them charge credit card customers 23%. They can earn the money by extracting more money from consumers. And the economy is the banks. They're our campaign contributors. What Geithner said yesterday to the economy, drop dead. I care about Wall Street, and that's what the administration's all about.
So what it comes down to, Michael, is there's no way in the world you can strengthen an economy by giving all this money to bankers. They're not using it to lend. They're using it to pay out.
Yeah.
Well, to pay out big bonuses.
But they're adding on to the credit card balances the automatic accrual. Most of the debts that Americans have are not money that has been lent out. It's just the accrual of interest on the credit card. The banks don't really lend you the money that they charge in your credit card and the fees every month. They just keep on adding the debts to the balance. And that's why Iceland is so important. It's an example of how far you can push the population by simply adding to the debts they owe without actually giving them more money at all, and not without creating any credit at all to finance new means of production.
And this is exactly what they want. The scheme is, you use the phrase, I think I've used it too, permanent debt bondage. They don't want loans repaid. They just want them to get bigger and bigger, so the debt service gets bigger and bigger, and that's the way they make their money. And ideally, this will go on forever and ever and ever.
This is what Mr. Geithner said. He said that in order to have recovery, we're defining recovery as getting the banks lending again. What the banks lending again means debt growing again. So recovery means the population getting deeper into debt. That's what Geithner said. That's what Obama has said in his last two speeches. So if he defines recovery as going deeper into debt, I can guarantee you that we are going deeper into debt. So in his word, there will be a recovery this year, meaning Americans will be more indebted, the house prices will fall further, there will be more foreclosures. That's what he calls recovery. The English language is very flexible if you use Orwellian doublethink.
They seem to do very well by creating bubbles, Michael. It seems to me that the scheme now is, well, the other bubbles have popped and they've been deflating, so let's inflate a new bubble or two or whatever.
I don't think they can. I don't think you can't inflate a bubble when you begin from a position of negative equity. And if you already have one-third of American homes and office buildings worth less than the mortgage, there's no way in which there can be new loans for that. All there can be will be foreclosures.
How do they get people to borrow more when banks won't lend to people they feel?
You don't lend to them. Remember, they pay their arrears mount up. So essentially, the banks, it's as if the banks lend them the interest. The banks don't really lend them the interest. They charge the interest to the account, and then say that they have an increased claim. So on balance sheets, the volume of debts and assets go out without any real credit being created, except, crediting, debt, claims to the bank and, imposing a, rising volume of debt to the credit card holder.
So it basically is just, it's the existing debt that's owed, whether it's on credit cards, whether it's on mortgages.
It has its own momentum. And its momentum now is still siphoning off interest from the rest of the economy. And when the interest can't be paid, it mounts up. Just like on these houses that are being foreclosed, the banks add collection fees, they add penalties. And all this appears as a rising bank asset. But it's an asset, a claim, that'll never be paid because the banks already, the houses are abandoned. Nobody can pay these fees and interest.
So conceivably, we could have something that looks like some kind of recovery in the months ahead, whenever it might start. But it will be an illusion. It will not be a recovery.
There won't be a recovery of consumption. There won't be a recovery of employment or output. It'll solely be an increase in debt. And it could be an increase in the stock market, as people now realize. That the government, if the government's created $9 trillion worth of debt in the last year, not counting the $5.2 trillion for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, if the government gives the banks $9 trillion, obviously bank stocks are going to go up because they go up by the amount of the $9 trillion that the banks have been given. So it's easy to create a rise in the Dow Jones average when the Dow Jones industrials are no longer really industrials at all. They're Citibank, and they're the financial institution. So you'll have the industrial average going up because of government bailouts while the economy is sinking deeper and deeper into debt and unemployment.
What's the longer-term effect of this, Michael? We're printing all of this money. It's not for productive growth. It's going to the bankers.
We're creating debt. It's not really money. Money's not being spent. This $10 trillion that I mentioned is the cash for trash swap. In other words, the government gave treasury bonds or Federal Reserve deposits in exchange for junk mortgages and junk derivatives and bad gambles that have no chance of being repaid. So essentially, they just swapped treasury debt for bad private sector debt. So that's not really money. None of this money is being spent on goods and services. It's all on the balance sheets.
Well, it's on the balance sheet, but we've got all of this money out there. Isn't there a future inflationary problem from this?
No, there's a debt no inflation at all. There's a debt deflation. For an inflation to occur, people would have to be buying goods and services with more and more income. They don't. The income's going down. So it's a deflationary situation. That's why Irving Fisher called his book Debt Deflation. There may be an inflation of stock market prices temporarily, but there's no inflation at all of consumer prices or housing prices. If there was a inflation, which is what the Federal Reserve wants to create, then you'd have housing prices recover. You'd have markets recover. You'd have prices going up, but prices are going down.
There has to be a long-term price to pay for this. What is
poverty. Poverty.
Aside from ordinary people like the ones who are listening to this program, for sure they are paying the price right now and they will ahead. I guess the ultimate price to be paid is ordinary people will be sucked drier and drier and drier.
Their taxes will have to somehow these extra $10 trillion worth of bonds. This is crippling the American federal debt. Somehow the money to pay these bonds is going to have to be paid by taxing the American people. Because in the past, the Treasury financed itself by foreign central banks recycling dollars. And now they've already said they're going to stop that. So for the first time since 1971, Americans are going to have to finance their own domestic debt, including their military spending abroad. And if you spend money on military overhead, you're not going to have it available for to produce goods and services that people actually buy to live on.
Correct me if I'm wrong. It seems to me that a very healthy step that obviously is not being taken and won't be taken would be to take all of these major banks that are effectively insolvent, shut them down, salvage the parts that are good, break them up into small pieces. These major banks don't serve the general welfare.
That's they right. That was the result of the Democratic Party policy under Clinton repealing the Glass-Steagall Act. That has led the banks to become financial conglomerates with a conflict of interest that's led to all of this. Of course the banks should be gone under, and the speculators who the banks owed money to, the gamblers that AIG owed money to, should lose on the gambles. It's just like the Icelandic situation. These derivative trades and gambles and options are a zero-sum game. For every winner, there's a loser. The hedge funds were the winners, and the banks are the losers, and the easiest thing for the economy would be to cut out the cancer, to let the assets and the debts go under and have a clean slate when it comes to all this gambling and not permit a resumption of the derivatives trade. But just the opposite. They're sacrificing the real economy to pay Wall Street and to bail out the financial sector, and that's upside down. This is against everything that the real free market economists like Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill defined as free markets.
What does industrial America have to say about this? It's suffering greatly. The auto companies, of course, are the most prominent, but there's a lot of pain in industrial America watching these bankers get all of this money, and their business is pretty rotten.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I mean, they do.
But you have the Wall Street Journal, of all things, protesting against this. So the irony is you have the right-wing papers, the libertarians and the Republicans and the Wall Street Journal opposing the bailout, and the Democrats that are supposed to be the Labor Party supporting it all.
And, of course, the Democrats gave us the repeal of Graham-Leach-Wiley.
And continues. They gave us Geithner at the Treasury right now. They gave us
indeed.
Obama.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. Summers. I wonder who the most powerful one is. My nominee is Summers.
Summers, yes. He seems to have left everything in Summers' hand. And as I said before, if you want to see what their plan is, look at what they did in Russia after 1996. We already have their idea of neoliberalism. It sacrificed the economy to pay the financial sector. And while, I voted for Obama because at least you think that if somebody understands the situation, they're going to do the right thing. But Obama understands it and is doing the wrong thing. He said, I understand it. I know where my money's come from. It's come from Wall Street, and I'm going to repay my campaign contributors. What's the point of getting the support of the American people if you can't sell it and turn it into something? So he sold out the support he's got for Wall Street.
He didn't surprise me one bit. I followed him all through the campaign, Michael. Of course, he was my senator in Illinois, and I wrote about his voting record in the Senate. I took a look at where his big finance campaign contributions were coming from. Right up at the top, there were several at the top, but among the ones at the top were big Wall Street interests and big lobbying interests. It was very clear to me where the debts had to be repaid above
all
others.
Well, don't forget the Chicago real estate interests, the Pritzkers and the Crown family.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Penny Pritzker and his main financier raised many, many millions of dollars for him. So she's a power behind the scenes. My understanding of Penny is that she wants to have a lot of influence, but she does not want a public position. So she can waltz into the White House anytime she wants and have her say. And she'll be there when re-election time comes around. I have to wonder, Obama's approval ratings are very high. I have to wonder, will people be deluded that long and not get upset at some point? I hope they'll get upset.
That'll be very interesting to watch that and to see at what point. I think they'll get angry at a point when they realize that despite the fact that he's very nice to listen to, and despite the fact that he's smart, and despite the fact that he's done a lot positive for race relations in this country, that somehow when it comes to the actual policies, they're suffering, and they're suffering as a result of that he had a chance to use his great popularity to produce support the real economy against Wall Street, and he muffed it. He didn't do it.
He blew it. People should remember that George Bush came in as a good old boy. People liked him, a guy you'd like to have a beer with. We saw the way he ended up with the lowest approval rating of any president. We have to break again within the last few minutes, Michael. And your last thoughts in the last few minutes we have when we come back. We'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Back to the News Hour, final segment with Michael Hudson. Michael, I just got an email with a little bit more detail on today's employment report. The official number was 539,000 jobs in April lost, compared to an average of 680 over the past 5 months. But there's one big glaring thing. This is the official number, which is really fiction. The number is really a lot more than that, and then they revise it later on anyway. But there was a 66,000 job increase in the federal government, mostly due to the 2010 census. So without that, the April number would have been 611. What it will be when they revise it again, who knows? So I guess the best you can say about this, if there's any accuracy in this number, is it's terrible. It just isn't as terrible as the previously reported numbers.
Well, the Dow Jones Industrials are up over 100 points, so the financial sector says that's great news. Wages are going to go down. It'll increase profits. So Wall Street's very happy about the high unemployment numbers.
It's astonishing. I think during bull markets, Michael, they're not too happy when there are too many job increases.
I don't think this is a bull market. I think it's sort of a sucker's market.
Well, I don't think it's a bull market either. I think we're in a secular bear market, and I agree. I think this is a sucker's rally. But, of course, they can be pretty strong. They can be awfully strong.
Yeah, they usually are. They're 20% off.
We had one in the 1930s that, we had a bit of a recovery from 33 to 37. And I learned recently, to my absolute astonishment, that the Dow average rose 335% from its low, down 89%, but then it plunged again 1937-38. I guess Roosevelt declared victory too early or whatever. But, we had a pretty dark decade, and I think you see some pretty dark times ahead.
That's what it looks like all over. And the question is, what countries are going to break out of the whole system? They can't break out without a debt write-down, and that's going to be the problem. Many people think it's unthinkable to write down the debts, but if they don't write down the debts, the economy is going to shrink and shrink and shrink.
If we only could do the solutions are pretty simple, aren't they, basically, Michael, at heart? get rid of a private bank controlled Federal Reserve, let government create its own money, interest free, debt free, inflation free, create as much as we need, proportional to the growth that we want to create.
The problem is what the money's created for. The commercial banking system has created credit simply to bid up prices of stocks and bonds and real estate. Banks don't extend credit for industrial capital formation or industrial investment. So you need the monetary system to focus on actual capital formation, whereas it's become decoupled.
And back in the colonial days, beginning even before the Bank of England was created in 1694, the colonists created their own money and for 25 years had continual prosperity because there was no income tax. It was inflation-free. It was a wonderful period until the Bank of England got hold of us and changed everything.
That was part of the problem. It's really more that you can't blame it on the Bank of England. It was a mentality that government credit creation is unproductive. And that myth has been broken in the last year because you realize that all of the commercial credit creation is unproductive. And governments at least create money to build infrastructure or for social purpose spending. So no matter how bad an unproductive government spending is, it couldn't be worse than commercial bank credit creation.
We need to see an awful lot of angry people just decide they don't want to put up with this anymore. We're ready for them. There's something like 800-plus FEMA concentration camps around the country expecting unrest in future months.
I'm not sure what they're for. I can't make head or tail of that.
Oh, well, they're there. I guess they can throw a lot of people in them if they want to. But, Michael, as always, the hour goes by too fast. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you will come back and we can do this again before too very long.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And we'll be back again on Monday. We've got a full slate of live programs next week. Join us then.